Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriveInFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. Okay, fess up. How many of you have gone shopping, then cut off and hid the price tags and run the bag out to the recycling bin? Or maybe you paid for that new 9-iron with cash, so it wouldn't show up on the credit card statement. Yes, there's more than one way to cheat in a relationship.
My financial infidelity was waiting until he was asleep, stealing the money out of his pockets, putting it back in the bank and back on the cards immediately so that we were never deep in debt.
We'll talk. And we'll get real about getting ready for life's final curtain call.
It's terribly scary. You know, it's like the monster in the closet. But when you open the closet, the monster is not there. And it's going to happen to all of us.
Yes, it is. That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Sometimes we run a story and you think, that just can't be true. Like last week when we said you could take early Social Security payments, pay back Uncle Sam, and then take the payments again. Well, it was true, and apparently very confusing. You want answers? We got them. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
We've gotten quite a bit of feedback about our story last week on a little-known option for Social Security recipients. Marketplace's Bob Moon told us how it's possible for those who choose an earlier but smaller Social Security benefit to restart the clock. Essentially, those retirees can give themselves a future raise. You wrote in asking for more information on how this all works, so Bob is back with us to help clarify a few things. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tess.
So this sounds like a pretty good idea, but I guess it's something that you really shouldn't rush right into before you understand how it's going to affect your particular situation.
Exactly. Talk to a financial planner, or if you can afford some special software that's been put together by Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff at Boston University, you can crunch the numbers yourself and make certain assumptions about your financial future and the impact that this might have.
Who might actually benefit from this taking Social Security, paying it back, and then taking it back again?
Well, the experts we talked to say depending on your situation, and that's really key here, if you're already taking your Social Security benefits and you're somewhere between, say, 63 and 75, you could very well benefit here. But remember, you're making something of a trade-off because you have to pay the government back for every cent that you've already received in benefits. And for a lot of beneficiaries who just don't have that money, $30,000, $50,000, maybe $100,000, that's going to make you swallow real hard about whether this is worth it.
Now, Bob, Professor Kotlikoff argues that you may be spending down your nest egg, but you're going to guarantee yourself a higher income if you live past your life expectancy. Here's how he explains it.
That's a major risk that people face in old age that they don't really focus on because somehow everybody expects to die on time. But lots of people aren't dying on time. Lots of people are dying very late in life these days, and you have to worry about that downside.
Now, here's the thing, though, Tess. If you die before that and you've paid all that money back, then you've lost the bet. You leave all that money with your Uncle Sam. The thing to think about here is that if you do maybe just one, the wife or the husband, mm-hmm. who gets the bigger benefit, then the person who survives the longest still receives that bigger check. So you may want to put together at least some of the money and see if you can do this because it might be worth it.
And then you're not paying back quite as much as you would have otherwise.
That's right.
Okay. So if you do decide that you can benefit from this, what do you have to do?
Well, it's as simple as filling out a Social Security form to withdraw your application for benefits. And of course, then you have to give them the check. And then once you've done that, you can turn right around and reapply for the higher benefit that you're eligible for at your current age. and that goes up for around 8% every year until you reach age 70.
Okay.
And it gets real complicated, so
yeah.
We're going to put a lot of links on the website, including the form you'd have to use and some case studies that Professor Kotlikoff has done to try to help you understand all this.
All right, Bob. Thanks so much for coming back to help us out.
Thanks, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
Ever think it might just be easier to keep something from your spouse? It would be if you were living in magic no one ever finds out land. We found some credit counselors who are reporting that in the last few months they've noticed an uptick in calls from one half of a couple. The caller asks the counselor to send all the forms to, say, their mom's house or their personal email account. Counselors call it financial infidelity, and it's about a lot more than money. Ashley Milne-Tite has her story.
Michael McAuliffe has been a credit counselor for 15 years, but even he was shocked recently when one of his staff spoke to a man who'd racked up $300,000 in credit card debt, which he hadn't mentioned to his wife. McAuliffe is president of Chicago-based Family Credit Management. He says the guy was a salesman.
And he kept thinking that next big sale was going to come. And, you know, he didn't want to adjust his standard of living. He doesn't need to tell a spouse about it because he's just waiting on that big sale. But now he can't get any more credit cards to use.
McAuliffe says the counselor tried to persuade the man to come clean, but the caller was adamant. He was afraid his wife would balk at the idea of curbing her lifestyle, never mind her reaction to the prospect of filing for bankruptcy. McAuliffe says his staff usually gets 2 or 3 calls a month from people hiding their debt from their other half. Now, he says, with the economy in a downturn and people's credit maxed out, there's a call like this every day. But why the secrecy?
I can answer that so clearly. It's fear of rejection.
Mary Hunt knows all about the fear of rejection. These days, she's an author who runs the website debtproofliving.com. But as a young married woman in the 1970s, she was determined to live the high life, regardless of her husband's pleas for frugality. She opened multiple credit card accounts and piled up debt, much of it on the sly.
I had a secret post office box where I would get bills that would come to make sure that he didn't see them, because it was just easier for me to deceive him to keep what I thought was harmony in our marriage.
She says she was terrified he'd leave her if he discovered how lavish her spending had become. But it's not always fear of a breakup that drives overspenders to keep their activities under wraps. Alan has been a member of Debtors Anonymous for 14 years. He says for men like him, familiar old attitudes can play a role.
The thing about it is, it's an ego thing. For some reason, men feel that if they tell someone that they can't handle their money or they're way out over their heads, they think that someone's going to look down on them and shame them because, what, are you an idiot? You can't handle your money?
Alan says buying the latest gadgets for himself and the cutest clothes for his kids made him feel good, even if he couldn't afford it. In the early 90s, his widowed father moved in with him and his wife. Alan forged his dad's signature to open a credit card in his name. The card arrived and the spree began. One day his wife unearthed one of the bills. She asked how his stroke-stricken father could have spent $5,000 on all this stuff.
I said, I don't know. I have no idea. I just denied it point blank.
But his wife was persistent. Finally, he admitted the truth. He joined Debtors Anonymous that very day. Recently, he celebrated his 25th wedding anniversary. Occasionally, financial infidelity plays out in unexpected ways. Eve Pidgeon now heads communications for credit counseling firm Greenpath Incorporated. She's a saver. Her ex-husband was a spender who loved credit cards. He used to walk around with his pockets stuffed with $20 bills.
My financial infidelity was waiting until he was asleep, stealing the money out of his pockets, putting it back in the bank and back on the cards immediately so that we were never deep in debt.
Her intentions were good. Still, debt experts say honesty is usually the best policy. Mary Hunt of debtproofliving.com says for people hiding debt from a spouse, there's a right time to come clean.
Don't even think of doing this until you are come to the place where you have 100% genuine remorse. No excuses. Nothing other than, I am so sorry. And here is my plan. You've got to have a plan for what you are going to do to change this.
Whether it's credit counseling, she says, or getting a second job, or a first job, as in her case. Hunt says when she finally revealed the extent of their debt to her husband, he didn't walk out. He told her they'd pay it off together. She says they finally began talking about their different attitudes to money, and talking about that made them open up about a lot of other things. 38 years after first hitting the credit cards, she says their relationship is stronger and more rewarding than she'd ever thought possible. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, the Supreme Court recently has made a series of pretty important workplace rulings.
And you know, Tess, these rulings are upsetting some common assumptions about the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Roberts. Because remember, it's supposed to be a strongly pro-business Supreme Court.
Right. And I guess one of the more important rulings was one that made it easier for employees to prove age discrimination. Any theories on this kind of switcheroo?
My first theory is that we're in an aging society and there are going to be more older workers. And so I think what the age discrimination ruling does is it sort of codifies some common sense protections for older workers. I have a second part of my theory. Last year, the Supreme Court made a ruling that, in essence, made it impossible for women to claim gender discrimination when it comes to pay.
Right. And that's because you would have to do it really early in your time with the employer.
180 days.
Yeah.
All right. Now, first of all, as we know, it's hard enough to figure out or learn what people are earning. So that could take longer than 180 days.
Right.
Plus, there's a compounding effect. Oftentimes, the gap grows with time. So, you know, that ruling was so out of touch with reality that I think even the Supremes were a little bit embarrassed.
Well, let's start with the age discrimination case. This is where a company had laid off 31 employees. 30 of them were over 40 years old. Now, the court said basically in a situation like this that it is the company's burden to explain what happened here, to prove that it was something other than age. So the burden is now on the employer.
Right. And I think that's the way it should be. And by the way, the employer can have some other reasons and they lay out what those reasons are.
Right.
And then it can be fine or not.
I want to also ask you about a second case that the court ruled on. This is interesting. It has to do with insurance companies that both administer health and disability plans and then also are responsible for deciding which claims are valid and which aren't. Now, the court says that that is a conflict of interest that lower courts can take into account when employees decide to sue when they are denied benefits.
This is a really important ruling. And basically what it's saying is you can't cherry pick. And therefore, when they're looking at your health, they're looking at what's going on here, they really do have to act as a neutral arbiter, which is really what most of us employees expect. And what has been the real shock in the past decade or two has been sort of a gradual shredding of that safety net. And really, it's part of a longer-term trend of employees having to bear more and more risk in our society and less risk being borne by the employer and the insurance companies. So it's a good step. It's a nice step, and I applaud it.
All right. The Straight Story from our economics editor and resident court watcher, Chris Farrell. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Up next, even a former cabinet secretary has a tough time figuring out how he's going to pay for a little time off.
The dollar is so weak against the euro, that European vacation I was dreaming about would have cost me a fortune anyway. So I canceled that trip.
And speaking of the dollar, you can make a fortune by cost averaging it. Yeah, we'll explain. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Okay, class, summer school is back in session. Today, dollar cost averaging. Highly appropriate after a week that saw the Dow drop to its lowest point of the year. If you're an investor, dollar cost averaging could save you. At the Blackboard, our returning professor, Chris Lowe.
The idea of dollar cost averaging is buying into a fund, usually an index fund, where you invest the same amount of money in every period, so that what you're going to find is that you own more shares than if you pick an amount of shares to buy every quarter, because when the price is down, you'll get more. People use dollar cost averaging as a disciplinary tool. The temptation as an investor when the market pulls back is to shy away from it and not buy. And when the market is strong, the temptation is to chase it and maybe invest a little more than you would otherwise. Dollar cost averaging forces you to have the discipline to buy when stocks are low and use a little more restraint when stocks are high. And as a result, over time, it tends to outperform even stock picking, where sometimes we get too smart for our own good and tend to chase after things. The purpose of it is to prepare you for retirement. The discipline of putting money away every quarter or every month without thinking about it and finding at the end that you've probably saved quite a bit more money than you would if you tried to pick the optimal times to invest.
Chris Lowe is an analyst with FTN Financial in New York. Americans aren't the only ones bummed out about the price tag of a vacation across the pond. Tourism officials all over Europe are trying to reassure us Yanks that a holiday there wouldn't be that bad. The Emerald Isle just launched a campaign with the tagline, "Ireland, can you afford not to go?" Yes. Commentator Robert Reich thought he probably couldn't afford a trip. Then he did the math.
After finishing what I can honestly say was a hard year's work, I decided to dip into my savings and take a vacation this summer. But when I looked into my savings, I discovered there were a lot less of them than when I last looked. Well, the dollar is so weak against the euro, that European vacation I was dreaming about would have cost me a fortune anyway. So I canceled that trip and congratulated myself on saving thousands. So many Europeans will be vacationing over here to take advantage of the strong euro that I figure America's prime getaways will seem European anyway. Cape Cod will feel like the Riviera. The Rockies will have the ambience of the Alps. So then I decided to hop into my car and head to one of those great USA getaways. But with gas up around $4 a gallon, I figured I could save a pile of money by canceling that plan too. What's wrong with home, I asked myself. It will be a great chance to walk around and sample the local cuisine. But with food prices soaring, local restaurants are becoming much more expensive. So I figured I could save even more money by planting my own vegetable garden and eating at home. And what's wrong with eating your own vegetables? It's healthier that way. By this time, I figured, with all the money I'll have saved by not going abroad, not taking that road trip, not eating out, and by growing my own vegetables, I'll just about have broken even with my losses in the stock market. But, of course, I won't break even if the stock market keeps dropping. So I've decided to forget about saving money this summer. I'm driving to Europe, eating at every first-class restaurant along the way, and to hell with my own vegetables.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. All right, take a moment, clear your mind of pre-vacation worries. Forget high gas prices, forget higher airline prices. You are going on a vacation this summer. But here's something to worry about once your trip is underway. Some deals are too good to be true. Joining us is Pauline Frommer, the creator of Pauline Frommer Guidebooks, and she's here to talk about travel scams. And Pauline, what are some of the warning signs for consumers?
Well, you know it's a scam if a travel company contacts you out of the blue. A legitimate travel company doesn't need to do that. Other common scams are when they tell you that if you join this travel club for X amount of money, you're going to save hundreds and hundreds of dollars. There are a couple of legitimate travel clubs, but I'd say the vast majority are just scam operations.
Well, let's go ahead and travel and actually get on the plane or the cruise ship. But here we still have issues with potentially getting scammed. What's the most obvious technique that you should be on the lookout for?
Well, when you have people meeting you at the airport and trying to get you into their cab to go to a hotel that they know about, that can often be a scam or worse. There's another really, well, more and more common hotel scam. It's 11 o'clock at night, you're in bed, and you get a call. You think it's from the front desk clerk saying, "Oops, sorry, we don't seem to have the right credit card number for you. Does your credit card end in these numbers?" And you say, "Oh my, no." And they say, "Well, just give us your credit card number now. And what is this exact spelling of your name?" And it's a very common way, because people at 11 o'clock, they don't want to get dressed and go back down to the front desk. But in a good hotel, they're not going to call you at 11 o'clock. Even in a bad hotel, they're not going to call you at 11 o'clock to re-get your credit card number. They'll wait till the morning.
So that's pretty much like being stateside in your own home. You never want to give out your credit card number over the phone, especially if someone is calling you and you are not calling them.
Right. Never, ever give your credit card number to anyone. Unfortunately, identity theft is a big problem, and it can happen to you when you're traveling.
You know, one popular vacation option is taking a cruise, and a lot of times people go out and shop like crazy at ports of call. What are the most important things to keep in mind if that's your idea of a good time?
Well, I'd say never have anything shipped back to you unless you really, really know the vendor. I once got a letter from a reader who went to Istanbul, bought what he thought was a gorgeous carpet, but when he got it home, or when they sent it home to him, it was a cheap synthetic carpet that they had switched with the one he thought he had bought.
What about how to avoid being overcharged for everything from a cab ride to a tour around town? How do you know what's a valid price and what's not?
Well, you do your homework. Pick up a good guidebook. You go on the internet and you figure out how much this taxi in from the airport should cost, and how much the tours are going for in the location that you're in. Unfortunately, sometimes it's the established businesses within the travel industry that are putting in these hidden charges. For example, PricewaterhouseCoopers just recently did a study, and they found that in 2007, the American hotel industry charged consumers $2 billion in hidden fees, a resort fee for going to a hotel that has a pool, whether or not they use the pool. They're getting charged if they cancel their reservation less than a week in advance. It used to be that you could cancel 24 hours in advance. So it's more important than ever to read all the fine print before you decide on your hotel.
Are they required to put that in the fine print? I mean, if they're hidden fees, how do you know what to look for?
In most states, they are required, but sometimes, you know, it'll be on the fourth page of their website, so you have to really search for these fees. You usually can find them, and if you ask, they should disclose them over the phone, but you have to ask. They're not going to tell you.
All right. Pauline Frommer is the creator of Pauline Frommer Guidebooks. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
It's time for Getting Personal. That's when we answer your money questions. And with me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go to the phones right off. Ben is with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
What's your question for Chris today?
Well, my company has this plan called an employee stock purchase plan. And the way it works is I can put from 1% to 10% of my money into it, and they'll stow away the money. And then at the end of each quarter, they sell me the company stock at the lowest price it was available during that quarter, using the money that I put away. So I got a raise recently, and I'm thinking what to do with some of the extra money. I was thinking of putting, say, 1% of my money into the stock plan, which is called the ESPP. And it seems like a good deal, because on a quarterly basis, I'm always buying low, or I could start a Roth IRA, and I'm trying to figure out what's the better bet.
Well, Chris, a couple of different options here. What's your recommendation?
It's absolutely fascinating because my, you know, initial instinct, Ben, with this kind of question is diversification. And that's always a concern because you have your, you know, what's really your big return is your salary coming from the company. And then when you're buying the stock, you're putting a part of your long-term savings at risk to this company. So is that a good idea? But then again, you're only talking about 1%. And you're absolutely right. This is a way of guaranteeing that you can buy low. Are there restrictions on selling?
There are only the kind of restrictions like a blackout period kind of thing.
Exactly. So, you know, it would allow, gives you the opportunity to buy low and sell high. And you're only talking about 1%. And so I think it sounds like a pretty good move while you're working at this company to have this opportunity. Obviously, the Roth IRA over a long period of time is really a terrific thing to do. And, you know, when you can do it and as soon as you can do it, I'd recommend it. Even if you can't put in the maximum, just open it up and have some money compounding. But here you have an opportunity to take advantage of a financial scheme most of us don't. And you're not talking about getting greedy and you're not talking about putting too much of your portfolio into it. So I think it's a pretty savvy move.
What do you think about the idea of like putting some money into it and then every year or whatever, selling what I've got so far and putting that in the IRA because I've already got the short-term advantage?
Right. Now, will the company allow you to do that?
Yeah, as long as I don't sell it, you know, right before our quarterly reports or whatever.
I think it sounds good. You'll look at the capital gains because you'd want to pay the low capital gains rate. So buy low, sell high, pay the capital gains tax rate, and invest that money long-term in a Roth IRA. Sounds like a good move to me.
Great. Thanks. I've gotten a lot of different advice, so this really helps.
Thanks so much for the call.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And just a reminder, we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, Chris, Sherry writes in to us from your neck of the woods, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay.
And her 20-year-old son is going to be in Prague this fall semester. I can vouch for the fact that he will absolutely love it, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. She's not sure what might be the best way to get some emergency money available for her son. She doesn't want to necessarily give him access to a bunch of cash so that he could spend it on, you know, all kinds of fun things in Prague. So she's wondering if they should get him a credit card or give him a duplicate of their card.
I wouldn't do the duplicate of their
card.
I think, you know, and you know your own son, but he's 20 years old, and I would have a conversation with him. You know, do you understand how credit cards work? You know, this is what, you know, mom and I work on a lot, or dad and I work on a lot, and, you know, what we've learned, what our experience is, and this is for emergencies. And you know your own son. You know, can you trust him? The other thing that you can do, remember, we live in the internet age. And so I assume that he'll have a debit card or he'll have some sort of card as he's traveling, and you can always put more money into his account in the internet age with online banking. It's just very easy to do. So that's another thing that you could do. But frankly, I lean toward the credit card, get it in his name, have a lot of very long conversations about credit cards and what your expectations are with that credit card.
Chris, what about getting one of those prepaid credit cards where you actually, you know, put an amount of money on it and then the son could not spend beyond that? Because the big issue, of course, with credit cards is that you spend beyond your limits or you spend beyond what you're able to pay back.
That's a good way of maintaining a certain amount of control. In other words, he can't get into real trouble, but he does have an emergency source of money. And just as general, as you described a test with one of these credit cards, you say put $500 or $1,000, whatever you decide is going to be in this special savings account, and the credit card can be used up to that limit.
Okay. Once again, our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Every year when the 4th of July rolls around, I get just a tad verklempt. L.A.'s fireworks scene is okay. The city where I used to live, now they know how to throw a patriotic party. Take a warm, starry night, add some food and wine with the Charles River just over there and the Boston Pops playing on stage at the Hatch Shell. All building up to a literal bang with Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we stand at the podium with their world-renowned conductor.
My name is Keith Lockhart, and I'm the conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. The Boston Pops is one of the oldest, and certainly for the average person on the streets, the most famous orchestra, at least in this country and on this continent. One learns to conduct through applied study at the beginning, at the school level, in classrooms, and with private instructors, in terms of just the physical language of conducting. There is an international language to conducting, which means that I can go in front of an orchestra in China, wave my hands, and be 75% sure that I'll get the response that I want. The problem with conducting is it's not like a normal job application. You actually have to be invited to an audition. Toward the end of the 1980s, I took an audition to be the assistant conductor of a small professional orchestra in Akron, Ohio. And from there, I moved on to Cincinnati, to the Cincinnati Symphony, one of the country's larger orchestral situations. And it was when I was in Cincinnati that I was noticed, as they say, for the Boston Pops job. It's a great cocktail party conversation starter because people just don't know very many conductors. They see a distant image of somebody standing on a podium wearing a tailcoat. On one end, they think the conductor does absolutely nothing and is just there for visual window dressing. And the other side is that they think that the conductor is somehow this megalomaniacal person who, every time they lift a finger, therefore the violinist is capable of putting their own finger down. And of course, that does a great disservice to the very talented people you're working with. People always ask, what's in your car? What do you listen to? What's on your iPod? And the answer is, I never listen to music outside of the context of my work, or rarely. For me, it's not relaxing because I listen to music with professional ears. And somebody actually understood the wisdom of that. They said, yeah, I'll bet PGA golfers don't play golf on weekends. Salaries vary on the upper end of the conducting profession. Someone can make $2.5 million a year. I suppose the bottom range of a conductor's salary goes down to $2,500 a year. Right now, my health care plan is involved being married to someone who does have a health care plan, and that's fine. I've had the normal things happen. Occasionally a baton flies into the air. One time I did lose a button on my pants and had to hold them up for the rest of the performance. Many people derive satisfaction from their work, but then you say, well, okay, you're going to win $10 million in the lottery tomorrow. Are you going to go back to work the next day? And they go, no, I'm going to go do what I've always wanted to do. The difference is that I am so blessed to be surrounded by something as wonderful as the world of music and actually be compensated for doing it.
Cue the cannons. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. For photos of Maestro Lockhart in action, go to marketplace.org. Coming up, we continue our series about planning for the end.
When they lose you, that trauma is so overwhelming. The last thing they need is to try to second-guess what you wanted.
Plus, how and whether to invest in a destitute country. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Today we continue our conversations about the end. It's called estate planning. As part of this series, we're talking to people who deal with death on a daily basis. Today, one of our listeners.
Hi, I'm DJ. I live in Durham, North Carolina. I've had a chronic illness for 14 years, and 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. And there's very little treatment. So I've been spending a great deal of time since I was given this diagnosis and declared as terminal, trying to put together the details of what I would like done, making all of those last-minute decisions, those last decisions in our lives, those very difficult decisions that we have to make about what to do with what remains after we leave. I'm 58 years old, and like so many people, I put it off for a very long time. But when I became chronically ill, I began to see the reality that we don't last forever. And I started thinking very long and hard about what would happen to my things, what should happen to my beloved animal companions, how was I going to make some arrangements for them and for my possessions. I bought a kit, and I did a will. And the will was okay, but I never really felt comfortable with it, because being that I am divorced and I live alone, I have no children, and I really have no living family now, a lot of the packages just didn't apply to the things that were important to me. So I thought about it, but I never made the appointment to go to the lawyer. And then when the doctor told me that I didn't have a lot of time left, I finally made an appointment with a lawyer who specialized in senior estate planning. I remember when my mother died and we had to go through her possessions. It was so hard to let go of anything, and my mother left a lot of things. It was so hard because I felt like every time I was getting rid of something, I was getting rid of a piece of her. So what I've done is given away a lot of things already, because I'm fortunate enough to know that I have a limited amount of time. I mean, in truth, none of us knows how much time we have left. And that's why even if you're healthy and strong and you live a great lifestyle, you never know what might happen to you. Please do this. You owe it to your family. You owe it to the people who love you. When they lose you, that trauma is so overwhelming. The last thing they need is to try to second guess what you wanted. Love them enough, love yourself enough to do this for them. Face your fears about it and just do it. It's terribly scary. You know, it's like the monster in the closet. But when you open the closet, the monster's not there. And it's going to happen to all of us.
That's DJ, a listener in North Carolina. She initially wrote to us with a specific question about cashing out her retirement money early. Chris will help her with that in a few minutes. For now, we're joined again by John Ventura. He's the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. And John, this week we're dealing with something called durable power of attorney. Where does this fit within estate planning?
The durable power of attorney is an important document for people that have, say, complicated business situation. Maybe they own a business, or they find themselves at an age when they really cannot make the daily financial decisions that need to be made about their life. Now, let me explain what it is. The durable power of attorney is a document where you give authority to a person to act in your behest. And what that means is that they can make all decisions that are necessary about your assets. You give them the power to sell your assets, to buy things, to enter into contracts for you, to make decisions about investments, to pay your bills. Another situation that may come up is incapacitation. If you suddenly have a stroke and you want all your affairs to be taken care of, you would want to have a durable power of attorney and a person designated to handle all your affairs if that should occur.
So is this something that you would want to do at almost any age?
You know, not everyone, I think, needs one of these things. But if you have a business, if you have a complicated financial affairs, debts that need to be taken care of, investments, property, then I think you should have a durable power of attorney and someone chosen that's going to make decisions for you if you're not able to do it.
How do you choose someone to represent you and your interests?
It's not easy to find the person that you want to have this authority over your assets. Of course, you know, you want to look at your relatives, people that you trust, people that you've known for a long time, but you have to think about not only do you trust them, but are they going to have the skills, the knowledge to make good decisions on your behalf?
What kind of skills would they need?
I think they would have to have some business skills in regards to how to maintain assets properly. In other words, how to manage assets so they're not depleted.
I think that would be also very hard for a lot of people to find that person.
It is hard for someone to find someone that fills that bill. You know, a lot of times a person will discuss this and choose a business person or perhaps a lawyer or someone at a bank that they've been dealing with for a long time.
How much power does durable power give you? Is this very broad? Is it limited?
You know, it could be either. A lot of times a durable power of attorney, or they're very broad and gives a person all the power that they need to deal with your assets. Sometimes you may have a power of attorney that's narrow, and you may say that this person has the right to deal with my real estate, but they're not allowed to sell it. They're just allowed to manage it. Or in investments, they're allowed to do certain things, but not other things.
Okay, so you need to be real specific about just how broad this power of attorney is.
Absolutely.
And what do you do with it when you're done with it? Does it go where your will is and where all of your other important papers are?
Yes. You need to make sure when you do a durable power of attorney, you're going to execute several original documents because you're going to want the person that's going to represent you. They need to have an original document, originally signed, not a copy, to present to the institutions. Again, this is not something that you want to put in a safety deposit box that's going to be hard to get to. You want it to be available as soon as something happens to you so that whoever's going to represent you can immediately start filling that role and taking care of your property for you.
John Ventura is the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Tess.
And John will join us in 2 weeks to go over medical power of attorney.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
All right, we're back with Getting Personal. And Chris, just a few minutes ago, we heard from one of our listeners, DJ in Durham, North Carolina. As we mentioned, she is terminally ill, and she talked a little bit about some of her estate planning. But, Chris, she also has some very specific questions for you about what to do with some of her retirement accounts. So thanks for joining us again, DJ.
Oh, thank you.
You want to tell us some of your specific questions here?
On a recent program, I heard that Chris said that if you had a 401k and you wanted to cash it in, that you had to take the entire amount. And I do have a 401k, and because I am terminally ill, the illness has exhausted a large portion of my savings, and pretty soon I'm going to need those funds. I am almost 59 years old, unfortunately not 59 and a half, and I was wondering how to handle this, how to move that money. Would it be best to move it over into several smaller IRA accounts so that I could access the money in smaller portions and therefore take the tax hit in a lighter form? Also, I was thinking about rolling it over into my credit union, some short-term CDs in my credit union.
So first of all, you don't have to take the money out in a lump sum. That's usually one of the options. The employer where you have the 401k, they have a lot of power how they write the rules, and some employers will let you take out, you know, small bits. Some just say, do it as a lump sum. Usually you have a set of choices. I think in your case, it makes, and actually for most people who are no longer working for the employer, to roll that money over tax-free into an IRA that you then control. Okay, then another part is if you tap the money and you're under 59 and a half, in your case, I don't think you're going to have to pay the 10% penalty. There is a disability exception. I rarely talk about it because very few people qualify for the disability exception. Because here's what the IRS says, and I'm just using hopefully English as opposed to IRS language. But you must be permanently and totally disabled with a long illness that will probably lead to death, and you must prove it with a doctor's assessment, and you're not working. So in other words, you're too sick to work. In your case, I think you meet all those qualifications, and therefore you don't have to worry about the 10% penalty. You'll still pay ordinary income taxes on what you withdraw, but you won't pay the 10% penalty even if you're under 59 and a half.
That's just really good news. Thank you.
By the way, also to IRAs. It's with 401k plans, IRAs, other types of company plans. Then on the rolling it over into a CD, you might want to put a good chunk of it into just a money market mutual fund, which you can have in an IRA. Normally we say don't do that because you want the compounding effect, but you want to be able to have immediate access to the money, quick access, and that'd be very liquid and, you know, make some rate of interest off of it. So that might be one route that you want to do. If you do want to put some in a CD, that's fine. You're completely protected. So that's one thing. That's an additional layer of safety.
What are the money market rates running right now? I mean, in general.
They're miserable. I'd say it's a little bit under 2%. It's around 2%. But here's the one trick. Let's say interest rates go up. The advantage of the money market mutual fund is that, let's say, short-term rates go to 4%. Your money market mutual fund will go from 2% to 4%. If you're in the CD, into that 3.5%, it stays at 3.5% until it matures, and then you can roll it over at a higher interest rate.
Well, thank you. That's really helpful. I didn't know any of that.
Well, DJ, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's a tough one, but we really appreciate that you're just so straightforward about all this.
Thank you. It's been really good for me to get this information so I can try to finalize a lot of these details.
Thanks so much for the call.
Bye.
Well, Chris, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But as folks know, you are answering personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on Getting Personal. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week, Zimbabwe held a presidential runoff with one candidate. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai pulled out of the race and sought refuge in the Dutch embassy. But longtime President Robert Mugabe refused international calls to postpone the election. Zimbabwe's economy has been in free fall since 2000, when Mugabe endorsed a violent land seizure program. Today, 4 out of 5 adults are unemployed, and the inflation rate tops 165,000%. But Gretchen Wilson reports from Johannesburg that some see opportunity in the country's sad situation.
Right after Zimbabwe's election in March, it looked as if President Robert Mugabe was on the outs. Zimbabwe's stock exchange soared, but it tanked again when he didn't step down. That shows just how closely hawk-eyed investors are watching the southern African country.
There's definitely, in terms of wanting to invest in Zimbabwe, I think there's definitely international interest.
That's Jeff Rothschild, Director of Government and International Affairs at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange.
The great entrepreneurs will see things before they happen, not after they happen. And the opportunity is now, before there's a change in government.
During Mugabe's 28-year tenure, most international investors have left Zimbabwe. One reason? Unstable fiscal policies make for meager profits. Another? Fear of being associated with Mugabe's regime and its alleged human rights abuses. Dale McKinley is an economic analyst in Johannesburg.
Because to be found out to be dealing with a moral and socioeconomic pariah would invite resistance, would invite potential shareholder criticism, would invite a whole range of problems at home.
But observers say that's changing. They say Zimbabwe is an endgame because no government in modern history has debased its currency this much and survived. And that's getting investors excited about Zimbabwe's potential. The country's bigger than Montana and has everything. Prime agricultural land, 12 million people, which means new markets for banking and telecommunications, and of course, commodities.
So everybody's looking to get in on the chromium, the gold, the platinum, all of those kinds of things.
Red-hot commodity prices are fueling growth. Platinum prices alone have climbed 90% since the beginning of last year. And African stock markets are on fire, from Ghana to Botswana.
You know, you just cannot believe the returns that we're talking about. Stock markets that are making 100+% growth. Those are just astounding returns.
That's filmmaker Carol Pinault. Her new documentary is called Africa Investment Horizons. When it debuted at the New York Stock Exchange in April, it was standing room only. She says the U.S. economy needs Africa to survive. We're talking crude oil from Nigeria and Angola and copper from Zambia.
And if we don't quite realize that, let me assure you the Chinese definitely know it, and they are heavily competing for all of those resources. If we don't hurry up and get it together to start really getting into Africa in a big way, the Chinese and Indians will have bought everything up.
China has traded openly with Mugabe's regime, even as the leader has been shunned by the IMF, World Bank, and Western countries. These Western donors are keen to bankroll a democratic government, but Zimbabwe may not be the investment Shangri-La that people are hoping for. Chris Hart is an economist in Johannesburg. He says people have to remember that this is nearly a failed state and that even in a recovery, its $10 to $20 billion economy is still relatively small potatoes.
And it'll be a long, long ride. It's not going to be quick and easy. The recovery process is going to be quite painful.
Painful because Zimbabwe will need to bring its inflation to a screeching halt and tame the widespread black market. To get the country's budget in the black, it will have to make significant cuts. That means government workers, like teachers and engineers, may lose their jobs. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a new playground for Americans.
We're moving tomorrow. You know, and then you get here and you live here and reality sets in. You go, oh, it's expensive here. It's expensive to go out.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, Jeff Peters, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.